previously on the British Broadcasting Century podcast.
While our main timeline finds us in 1923, we've leapt forward for a couple of episodes to 1924. King George V has given his first radio broadcast, and millions have heard his royal voice echoing throughout the land on loudspeakers hung in high streets, in parks, and from shop windows. But weeks later, can the BBC find similar success with a humbler, simpler sound from a Surrey garden? Music and nature in harmony together?
Yes, this time it's the centenary of the cello and the nightingale. The cellist Beatrice Harrison broadcasting live from the garden of her Surrey home, hoping the nightingales will join in and duet. We hear from her biographer, Patricia Cleveland Peck.
It was viral. It was like the Strictly of the day. People were madly keen, talking about it, phoning each other up. Some people listen to it on the phone.
As we do, we listen to radio now on the phone. And yeah, like Strictly, yeah. It's a duet, of course, a musical duet.
And in rare archive footage, we'll hear from Beatrice Harrison herself, as well, of course, as the sound of her beautiful cello and those wonderful nightingales. And we put to rest those rumours that the nightingale may have been faked in some way. All will be revealed. The tale of how it came together and the impact on the early radio listenership. The cello and the nightingale on the British Broadcasting Century.
Hello, hello. This is Paul Carenza calling.
This is London calling.
Hello, hello. I'm Paul Carenza. Thank you for joining us on the British Broadcasting Century podcast special. Our last in 1924 for now, until we retreat back a year to 1923 and continue telling that chronological tale of the earliest moments of British broadcasting. But we just had to land ourselves in 1924 for a couple of centenaries. So two episodes ago, you heard all about the first monarch on the radio and the earliest radio recording. And the history of radio recording, well, that will come back again this episode, because a few weeks after George V's opening speech at the Empire Exhibition, after a month or so of the usual talks and musical performances, the news, the weather and so on, the BBC had another innovation up its sleeve. It decamped to a Surrey home, and there in the back garden, Beatrice Harrison, the famous cellist, struck up her bow and hoped that the wildlife of her garden, particularly the nightingales, would join in. And they did. So popular was it that this became an annual fixture every spring on the BBC for over a decade. Now, normally before I start recording for this podcast, I close my windows here so the sound of birdsong won't come in from our garden. But today I thought, well, it's a beautiful spring day here and I have a Surrey garden. I'm not quite in Oxted, where Beatrice Harrison was. That's about an hour away from me here in Guildford. But it's a bright, beautiful day. The birds are singing. Occasionally a plane flies overhead. You may hear that as well. But that also feeds into this story of the cello and the nightingale. The first outside broadcast of nature. Or was it? Was the nightingale faked? Was there one before? All will be revealed this episode. And guesting on this episode, Patricia Cleveland Peck, the writer and historian who knew the Harrison family well. She'll tell us all about the Beatrice tale. Delighted to welcome to the podcast now, author of The Cello and the Nightingales, The Life of Beatrice Harrison, new book out now, Patricia Cleveland Peck. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Lovely. Well, thank you so much. I mean, who else could I speak to in this centenary moment of The Cello and the Nightingale? Because could you first of all tell us about your involvement in this in the past, the book?
Yes, certainly. Well, my involvement with the story is really personal, because I came to it as a writer rather than as a musician, because I knew the family. I knew her two sisters. Beatrice had died about a year or so before I actually met them. But my husband and I, we were newly married and we rented a cottage on their estate and became very friendly with the two old ladies. And they often invited us to tea and to drinks. And we heard these stories about the nightingales and about the music over the tea table. And at first we knew very little about it. We didn't know what the nightingales were. Is it an opera we've never heard of? And I decided that these stories were too good to lose.
It's one of those landmark things people talk about. We just assume has always been there. But there's no one around really now who
would have remembered hearing it particularly.
I was lucky because I did come into the story at the very tail end of people that had actually been involved. So I had the idea of writing a book about the four sisters, because the four Harrison sisters were all very, very musical. Two violinists, a cellist, and a singer. And none of them married, all devoted to music, certainly in their younger years. So I was going to write this book, but in doing the research with Margaret Harrison, the youngest sister, who was then, I suppose, in her 70s, they never threw anything away, which is an absolute bliss to a biographer. Everything was there. I don't know what biographers are going to do in the future with emails and things, but we had laundry lists, we had concert programs, we had letters. And eventually, out in the stables in a box, we found the manuscript that Beatrice herself had tried to write at the end of her life. Wow. And of course, this was absolute gold dust, because immediately I looked at it, I thought, this is her voice. I don't want to incorporate this into my book. I want to just make this her book. And that's what I did. But she had written it from memory. She hadn't consulted all the many concert programs and got it all in the right order. So I spent time reorganizing it into years and so on. The book came out, and that sort of caused a little bit of a renaissance for Margaret Harrison. She was a very first-class violinist in her time, but she got out of it. That brought her back into it and brought a bit, certainly brought Beatrice's name back into the contemporary cello scene. I did it just to get the story out, because it just struck me as such an amazing achievement to have got the BBC down there. And it was a fledgling BBC. It was a BBC that they didn't even record. They broadcast. This is where we've had a lot of controversy recently.
We'll certainly get to that, absolutely.
Yeah, first broadcast was just literally a broadcast. Mm. And in those days, in 1924, and slightly prior to that, it was a one-off. If it didn't work, you had to do it all over again.
But where to begin this tale then? Well, actually, I'd quite like to begin, if you'll indulge me, 7 years before the Cello and the Nightingale broadcast, and that is with John Reith in America in 1917, 5 years before the BBC even existed. He was over there looking after munitions. He'd been essentially taken away from the front line after that bullet grazed his cheek, leaving that scar for the rest of his life. And it's claimed that he may have even been the first British officer to go to America in the Great War. So he's in a place called Swarthmore in Pennsylvania, just outside Philadelphia. And Reith being Reith, he's going to church every Sunday. He doesn't really know anyone there. So every Sunday he gets invited to dinner by a different local family, and he slowly gets to know the people who he should know. And again, Reith being Reith, he sort of climbs the social ladder there and starts being offered things like Deputy Sheriff of Pennsylvania, of all things.
Edit. I meant Delaware. Deputy Sheriff of Delaware. As you were.
So one particular Sunday in 1917, he comes out of church, he's invited to dinner at the house of the Howard family. They've got a 16-year-old and they've got a 24-year-old. And the 24-year-old, called Philip, takes Reith on a bird hike. Yeah, so just exploring all the different birds they could find in the local area. They find 38 different varieties of bird. And now and then, Philip Howard imitates the different birds. Reith says it's a shame they can't hear the
rapturous and voluptuous song of the English nightingale.
And Reith then imitates it and does his impression of the nightingale there in the woods. Philip is amazed, probably at the fact that this random stranger has started impersonating English birds. Later on that very evening, after supper, Reith is invited to the top of the house, and in the 16-year-old's room, they have a wireless kit, and they hear the time signal sent from Arlington in Virginia, 300 miles away. It's the first time that John Reith has ever heard radio, as they call it in America, or wireless, as we would have it back here. That very same day, then, that Reith first encounters wireless, he's impersonating a nightingale. We'll see how that all ties up over the course of this episode. flash forward then to the BBC, the first couple of years, and the first outside broadcast happened on the 8th of January, 1923. The broadcasting of opera that convinced Peter Eckersley to stop mocking the BBC on 2MT Rittle and join them as chief engineer. Once he'd heard what you could do with an outside broadcast, he knew the rest was all about scale and scope and where you can take it from here. Well, it turns out you can take it out and about. And by the end of 1923, there was a
clear plan in place,
according to Arthur Burrows, the director of programmes in the Radio Times, to broadcast a nightingale.
On Saturday evening, November the 24th, 1923, Captain Eckersley demonstrated to this right little compact little island that he had out-Darwined Darwin, that he had discovered the missing link. The link is a baby wireless transmitting station, not even christened with call letters, which can be carried from place to place and renders unnecessary the use of telephone lines between the building in which an entertainment is happening and the wireless station broadcasting that entertainment.
In other words, an out-and-about broadcasting opportunity. Arthur Burrows continued.
How many are the odes to a nightingale? How many of us in the privileged South can claim to have heard this wonderful songster? Captain Eckersley and his assistants, possibly amidst protests, will change all this. Next summer, they will sally forth to many reputed haunts of the nightingale, and, if fortunate, will give to 500,000 homes the same that oft-times hath charmed magic casements. If unfortunate in their quest, we may rely upon PPE to provide an excellent counterfeit with reaction obligato.
In other words, just to decode that, Captain Peter Eckersley, PPE, had a history, in the 2MT Rittle days, of imitating performers, pretending that he had a guest artiste with him when actually it was him doing an impersonation for fun. So Burrows is here making a joke of the fact that if the nightingale doesn't sing, perhaps Captain Eckersley could impersonate it. We'll see later this episode how that ties up in a certain urban legend. As for the very idea to broadcast the nightingale, well, Beatrice Harrison, the noted cellist, suggested it to Rex Palmer while she was at London 2LO giving a performance of Elgar's cello concerto with Elgar himself with the baton in front of her. She knew that at her Surrey home, the nightingales did love to sing when she practiced playing the cello outside in the beautiful garden there. And someone who later lived on that premises, Patricia Cleveland Peck.
Beatrice was very familiar with the BBC in as much as several of her concerts, the Elgar, etc., had been broadcast to the nation and beyond. And that is what struck her, that if they can do that when I'm playing at Queen's Hall or wherever it was, why can't they come to my garden and do it and send it for people who haven't got gardens, who haven't got nightingales? And although she was the sweetest, gentlest character, she was one of those people with a little bit of a terrier in her, a bit of tenacity.
From Patricia Cleveland Peck's book, The Cello and the Nightingales, The Life of Beatrice Harrison.
I must confess, I had a hard tussle, as the BBC would not believe that such a thing was possible, and thought that it would be a waste of their time, a wild goose chase to come down to Surrey. But I knew that the good God wished the world to hear the duet of the cello and the nightingale. For nights I had crawled to find whence the most thrilling notes might ring out.
She absolutely carried on asking, and of course she was quite famous. I mean, she has been hailed as the major cellist of that era. And so she was quite important. So obviously they didn't want to offend her, but certainly Mr. Reith, as he then was, didn't initially think this was at all a good idea. Funny sort of moralistic arguments against it, that wouldn't it be terrible if people got used to listening to the nightingale on the wireless and not the real thing? And he compared it with eating tinned salmon rather than real salmon. I mean, that's so 1920s, isn't it?
It's very Reith as well, as an idea. Yeah. Well, if I may quote from your book, in fact.
I telephoned Sir John Reith at the BBC, who seemed very dubious at first. Meanwhile, the song of the nightingale was at its height at Foyle Riding,
her house,
and I knew that it must be now or never, as from now on he would sing later and later at night, and in 2 weeks he would be gone.
There you are. Yeah.
It's just a window opens in the month of May.
Yes, and
but it did take her a while, but obviously she got there in the end.
It was something to see all the paraphernalia of the BBC in our garden. It was a great risk, of course, as in those days no wild bird had ever been broadcast in its natural state.
Ah, well, there was one a little earlier that no one seems to know about, because it looks like Cardiff
just got to jump on them. 1st of April 1924, this article appeared in the newspaper.
Birdsong broadcast, another triumph for the Cardiff station. For several months, the officials of the British Broadcasting Company in London have been promising to listeners in that to the triumphs of the microphone will be added the capture of the wild notes of the birds of the country in their native haunts. There was charm in the idea, and listeners in have been waiting for the wireless record of the great out of doors. It has come, but not from 2LO. Cardiff has again led the way. Armed with a microphone, Major A. Corbett Smith...
See episode 68 of this podcast for more on Arthur Corbett Smith.
...has added another to the long list of his Cardiff first triumphs on the very eve of his departure for London.
Yeah, Rees poached him away from Cardiff because he was being too annoying and maverick. Ended up in a dead-end job at BBC HQ in London.
On Monday, he visited the towers of Llandaff Cathedral, and by the exercise of the patience necessary with stalking nature, captured the chirps, whistles, squeals, and flutterings of the feathered population of the towers, which were faithfully sent out on the ether from the Eldon Road station and tuned in at thousands of firesides in Wales and the West Country.
So that's a month and a half before the far more famous cello and nightingale from Beatrice Harrison's Oxted Garden. Thanks, Andrew Barker, our newspaper detective, for helping uncover this particular unsung part of the story. Either way, it's the cello and the nightingale that seems to have impacted the world, reaching far beyond local, regional radio, even beyond national radio. People in India and America were reported to have heard it. Reith's 1917 ponderings of whether America would ever hear the nightingale clearly underestimated what lay in his future.
It came down... And this famous day, set up all their equipment and they waited and they waited. And it was very funny. In fact, I've written also a radio play about it because it lends itself so much to recreating that moment.
So I've heard your fine radio play and it's marvellous. And also that sense of having to wait and wait and wait, which I think, is it Diana Quick, I think, is playing
That's
Beatrice?
That Diana Quick played Beatrice and Julian Lloyd Webber played the cello.
And on the programme Scrapbook for 1924, Beatrice Harrison herself gave her recollections.
Our house was quite near the wood and the engineers had put their gear in the summer house. And my signal to begin was the red glow of a cigarette. It was all fixed, and at about 9 o'clock, I thought that it would be time for me to go in the ditch. It was an old coat of father's and an old hat, and in I got, slightly crooked, of course, with my beloved cello, and there I sat and played.
They waited and they waited, and you've got the poor announcer saying the sun is setting over the hills and trying to fill in, because it didn't sing immediately, because I'm sure the chaotic thing of, you know, all the equipment and the people tramping about, wild birds don't like that sort of thing. Also, they had all these animals roaming around, making a noise, but at the last minute it did.
Here's a different insight shared with us by BBC producer extraordinaire Claire Wordsworth. Claire's work has included Barry Humphrey's forgotten musical masterpieces and the like on Radio 2. Gorgeous shows on the golden era of radio. And Claire has shared this from the musician Gerald Moore.
I often visited the Harrison family's home near Oxted in Surrey. Here they kept a menagerie. There were precisely 16 Aberdeen Terriers, a very fierce Airedale, and a huge wolfhound. Of budgerigars, canaries, and parrots, chirruping and chattering, many abounded, and two baby crocodiles ruminated noiselessly in a tank in the dining room.
Wow, noiselessly. If the crocodiles had made a noise, that could have been a very different duet, the cello and the crocodiles. No wonder the nightingales didn't sing to begin with. Perhaps they could see the crocodiles. Gerald Moore notes that one of his friends went down there to
attempt to alarm the nightingales into some sort of sound. Groping through the thickets to disturb the sleeping birds, he suddenly shone his torch on the interrogating ears of a startled donkey.
And unfortunately that night we hadn't put him in his shed. And seeing this poor engineer crawling, he gave him a whop, and over he went, microphone and all.
And frightened out of his wits, leapt in the air, dropped his torch, and got a thorn in his eye. His groans of agony, until he was discovered and relieved, mingled with the nightingale's plaint.
Ah, so it's the cello, the nightingale, and the injured nightingale disturber wailing away.
And then the donkey was so pleased with himself that he brayed loudly and skipped off. However, at 11:45, the nightingale began to sing the cello.
His voice seemed to come from the heavens. I think he liked the chant Hindu best, for he blended with it so perfectly. I shall never forget his voice that night, or his trills, nor the way he followed the cello so blissfully. It was a miracle to have caught his song, and to know that it was going, with the cello, to the ends of the earth. My excitement was intense. My greatest wish was accomplished.
You've got the Savoy Hill bands sort of on the air as well. Like, when do you cut out of then and cut into this Surrey woodland? You have people listening to a bit of jazz, and suddenly it's like the radio retunes itself and gives you, and now we go to this Surrey woodland for some classical, you know, some Danny
and
Boy.
And then people were absolutely on tenterhooks. And of course it went on throughout the Nightingale season, every evening, and then it went on for 12 years.
We've got some pictures, of course, as well, which we'll share on our social media pages and things. You can see the engineers down there in the garden.
Yes,
you can see what it would have been like.
And the equipment, which is a bit beyond me, but they apparently had a really good new broadcasting magnetophone microphone.
Ah, yes. Well, I know we have one of our listeners to the podcast and on the Facebook group is the grandson of Captain Round, who invented that microphone or innovated it.
Good.
Captain Round's latest microphone made all this possible. Go back to the early episodes of this podcast and you find broadcasting being made possible by shouting into microphones, just like a telephone handset. That's how Melba was heard throughout the Northern Hemisphere. How Lauritz Melchior, the Danish tenor, thought he could be heard back home, although his shouting just broke the entire station. But now Captain H.J. Round has innovated this brand new wonderful microphone. Well, I say that, even Captain Round himself acknowledged that he was standing on the shoulders of giants. From Wireless Weekly, 7th of May 1924, a letter from Captain Round himself.
Dear Editor, I have read with interest your article about the 2LO microphone, and I should like to be allowed to correct one or two points. Firstly, the microphone is constructed on the basic principles evolved by Mr. Adrian Sykes in a number of patents of his. Certain detailed patents and improvements rendered necessary by the requirements of broadcasting and the present designs are due to myself working for the Marconi Company. We call the microphone the Sykes microphone, not the Round microphone.
Well, I've heard some call it the Round Sykes microphone, others call it the Marconi Sykes microphone. Ultimately, it is the Round Sykes microphone. If the name Round is not in the title, it's only because Captain Round was far too modest to want it there. As indeed the editor's comment added after his letter to the Radio Times.
Captain Round's tribute to Mr. Sykes in no way minimises his own very valuable work in developing the microphone for broadcasting.
Crucially, this microphone meant you could pick up detail. Like, for example, a bird singing in a tree, not immediately near the microphone. So, armed with this microphone, a large portable A amplifier, a few batteries and a drum of cable, the assistant chief engineer of the BBC, A.G.D. West, and his assistant headed down to the Surrey garden of Beatrice Harrison. They installed all this equipment in one of the summer houses. All of this kit was linked up then to Beatrice Harrison's house and to her phone line, where it was then essentially sent via cable to Savoy Hill in London. And, of course, the newspapers went crazy for it. From the Daily Sketch.
With astonishing clearness, the liquid notes of a nightingale singing in the Surrey woods at Oxted were heard by many thousands over the wireless last night.
And John Reith in the Radio Times.
The nightingale has swept the country with a wave of something closely akin to emotionalism, and a glamour of romance has flashed across the prosaic round of many a life.
There's a marvellous article online by Ian Baird. We'll link to it in the show notes. And in there, he unpacks some of the future years of the cello and the nightingale. For example, the following year, they used two microphones, two magnetophones, in the hope of transmitting two nightingales. Yes, no longer a duet between cello and nightingale, but a trio, potentially, between cello, nightingale, and other nightingale. So with two microphones, this becomes, as Ian Baird says, the BBC's first use of fading and dissolving. He quotes Captain A.G.D. West, the assistant chief engineer of the BBC.
Clicks and noisy changeovers from one microphone to another could not be permitted, and the duplication of microphone amplifiers meant the transport of much additional gear to the spot. Thereupon, the fade or dissolve from one microphone to another was evolved and successfully used for the first time at Oxted.
Year after year, they returned to the garden and the nightingale sang and the cello played. In 1927, a recording was made by the HMV Gramophone Company, and that is what we hear today. In 1933, there's a Nightingale Festival held at Beatrice Harrison's home. People can come and see as well as hear the Nightingales live. But then in 1933, the Harrisons moved home and the broadcast duets stopped. But the broadcast did continue, Sorn's cello. Each spring there, you wouldn't hear the cello and the Nightingale, you would hear the Nightingale and the Nightingale. Famously then in 1942, on the 19th of May, the 18th anniversary of the very first cello and Nightingale, the BBC were there just to record the Nightingale, but now it's the Second World War, and overhead 197 Wellington and Lancaster bombers drowned out the sound of birdsong on their way to a bombing raid in Mannheim. Ultimately then, this meant that there could be no broadcast. Germans could be listening in and deduce where the planes had taken off from. But it was still recorded. So while listeners at the time didn't hear it, we can now. When the aircraft return back, there are 186 bombers instead. 11 planes never made it home. And when the warplanes pass, the bird song continues. It's one of the most cherished recordings of the 20th century. And despite its lack of traditional music, it's still chosen now and then on Desert Island Discs. Maybe then we should start talking about this thing that we've been hinting at, which is this myth, accusation, whatever you want to call it.
Yes.
Did the Nightingale sing, or was it a human imitator? So this accusation seems to have come about a few years ago particularly, but I've seen evidence.
I heard it. I heard it in the 90s. Heard it in the 90s. So did her sister. What it was the descendants of this Madame Soubiran, she's got several names, who claimed that she had been called in by the BBC in case the Nightingale didn't sing.
Well, we know there were murmurs very early on indeed. That article we quoted earlier even had Arthur Burroughs suggesting Peter Eckersley might imitate the Nightingale if it didn't sing. That was back in 1923, 6 months before the cello and the Nightingale's first broadcast. And then this from 1933, Popular Wireless magazine.
P.P. Eckersley writes, "Hearing is believing, but so adept has broadcasting become in faking the real thing, many people did not believe those Nightingale broadcasts were true."
In 2009, natural historian and bird enthusiast Jeremy Minot wrote in his book Birdscapes of how he had played the recording of the cello of the Nightingale to other experts.
"One said it sounded very odd, one said it sounded okay. When they looked at the sonogram, the sound picture, they did notice it contained unusual elements. I also played it to good bird watchers without telling them why. Half said, yes, it's a Nightingale. The other half said, not sure, something funny about that song. I do wonder if it is really a Nightingale at all. I'm convinced it was Madame Soubiran."
Madame Soubiran did exist, and she was a professional bird imitator. When it first was mooted, I said, well, of course, if they can produce some proof, we'll have to believe it. And rather than believe somebody who could produce no proof, I mean, the BBC doesn't employ people without some sort of documentation. Had they produced an invoice or a letter or a commission to this, okay, I would have believed it, but nothing was forthcoming.
And this was all revived then in 2022 when Private Passions on Radio 3 featured Professor Tim Birkhead. The press release for this programme became the basis of a Guardian article when the BBC's History Department was approached about this accusation of using a human instead of a Nightingale for that first broadcast. The BBC essentially said, well, possibly. But that then became this Guardian headline.
"The cello and the Nightingale, a 1924 duet was faked, BBC admits."
Wouldn't quite say the article says they admit it. They said it was possible. They didn't really look into it at all. And there's no real evidence.
I don't mince my words in my afterword in this book. I think it's extremely sloppy journalism. A lot of statements were made which should not have been made. We'll leave it at that because it's all in the book, what I think of it. Now, I don't want to cause any more. Yes. You know, it's over now. Nightingale sung several times. For a start, there were evenings when no Nightingale sung and wasn't covered up. There were no people brought into whistle. It was just said, didn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the only reason I sort of mentioned it at all is that I was chatting to someone last week about this centenary. He had heard of the Nightingale, the cello Nightingale story, but little more than that. And said, oh yeah, didn't I read somewhere that that was all faked? And I think this is the
final thing. I think it was Barclay, Leonard Barclay, who said, at the end of the comments about this, I shall never listen to it in the same way again. And that is what annoyed, I wouldn't call us the Beatrice fans, but the Beatrice supporters, because it's wrong that her reputation should be spoiled for something that wasn't true.
I listened back to that interview this morning. You can hear they sort of hint at things and discuss things. And already there's a problem where he says, oh, the BBC decided to make a wonderful live recording. Ah, recording. You see, all of this then is based not on any BBC broadcasts, but on the HMV gramophone recording from 1927. I've looked through the BBC sound archive records, and I don't think there's any broadcast that could have been ever recorded. The broadcast duets stop just at the point that the BBC start recording the occasional thing. So yeah, anything you ever hear of cello and Nightingale is not the actual BBC broadcast. They played the experts the wrong thing.
What they were listening to was the HMV recording. Mm. It was sort of ironic that they were all discussing the wrong thing.
Yes.
And
and even then, it's guesswork. Even then, they're going, well, it sounds like it might be good.
Yes,
in 1927 in a recording. And in fact, I noticed on the Private Passions BBC programme page, I just noticed this morning, after all the blurb about what's on the show, and I've never seen this on any BBC programme website before, it says a correction. Since we broadcast this programme, I'll read it here, new evidence has been brought to light. We've now learned that the recording initially believed to be the original 1924 broadcast of Beatrice Harrison and the Nightingale, as labelled by the BBC Archives and the National Sound Archive, is instead likely to be a commercial recording released in 1927 by HMV.
More
likely, it is. Labelling has now been corrected to ensure this mix-up won't happen again. Suggestions that the Song of the Nightingale in 1924 may have been sung by a siffleur are not new, but probably impossible to verify since it seems likely the original 1924 broadcast was never recorded, as recording technology didn't exist at the time. Claims about the real bird being replaced in 1924 by professional bird imitator Madame Sabouraud are based on written testimony, it says here, to the BBC from relatives of Madame Sabouraud, as well as accounts from Madame Sabouraud herself. There continues to be competing accounts of this extraordinary musical event, as well as huge public interest, demonstrating just how important the story of Beatrice and the Nightingale is in the history of broadcasting. The legacy of the cello and the Nightingale, of course, went on for decades. Here's a reminiscence from a Jackie Sopp on our Facebook group. Do find us on Facebook, British Broadcasting Century. We have a page and a group, and Jackie added this comment there. In the late 1940s, she said, my mother was listening on the wireless to a broadcast featuring music and a Nightingale. The Nightingale failed to put in an appearance, but my mother told me that with her door open, because we lived in the country, she could hear one in her garden. She said the broadcast was eventually abandoned with profuse apologies from the BBC. No Nightingale singing that night on the radio. But Jackie says her mother had to smile because her Nightingale kept on singing. So that's just one listener, Jackie's mum. Maybe on countless occasions, the cello played and the Nightingale was singing Where You Are, a duet hundreds of miles apart.
What I've done in this book is it's exactly the same book as Beatrice wrote, but I've done an afterword in which I gathered together as many of the Beatrice-related events that have come about since the first edition in the 80s. Mm. I've just written a slightly fictionalized version for children to be a picture book of this event. Wow. And I've got a character, and this is coming back to how I know that the fake business was not true, because I met this guy who was very, very old, and this was in the 80s, and he'd been there as a boy on the eve of the recording and when it was done. And because he was keen on early radio, he had been allowed to help lay the cables and everything. And he said to me, there was no woman hiding in the bushes. Beatrice was such an honest person. She would never have written what she did in her autobiography about that night had it not happened. She might have written nothing, or she might have admitted that she had some whistler in the woods. But she didn't. She gave a full account of that evening.
So you see everybody to the end of the earth. But there's the duet between the cello and the Nightingale. And I think it gave them such joy. I had such letters. I can't explain. 50,000 letters. All addressed to the Lady of the Nightingale, England.
Beatrice Harrison herself on Scrapbook for 1924.
To circle back to two episodes ago on the podcast, and a month earlier in 1924, when George V broadcast to the Empire, well, who won between George V and Beatrice Harrison? Who made more of an impact? George or Beatrice? Monarch or musician? King George knew the answer, as he told Beatrice one day when he was touring a recording studio and he found her there.
Suddenly the door opened and the king came in. He came up to me and after smiling and saying, "Nightingale, Nightingale," he said, "You have done what I have not yet been able to do. You have encircled the empire with the song of the nightingale with your cello."
Lastly for this podcast, I've just heard the sad news that Martin Muncaster has died, aged 89, the first face of regional television in the South in Britain. And he presented Come Dancing, Songs of Praise, radio, television, countless other things. I particularly mention it because I was due to interview him for the podcast in a few days' time, just a few days after he died. In fact, we were meant to meet up earlier this week, which would have been a day or two before he died, but I couldn't make it this week, so I'd postpone till next week. And now we won't hear his marvellous interview. I'd spoken to him on the phone. I'd been connected with him via a podcast listener. And I had a lovely chat with him last week when he was keen to tell us all about his fishing trips with John Snag back in the 50s and oh so many more things. Well, I hope he's now fishing with John Snag after all this time. And Martin Muncaster, we salute you. His book is still out there, The Voice, The Face, A Life in Broadcasting. My thanks then to Patricia Cleveland Peck, and her radio play, if you can find it, is The Cello and the Nightingale. It must surely be repeated for the centenary. Have a look on BBC Sounds. Her book, reprinted, re-released, and all jazzed up and looking beautiful, is The Cello and the Nightingales, The Life of Beatrice Harrison. And do also, if you would like to know more, read Ian Baird's wonderful article, part of the Science Museum Journal. We'll link to that in the show notes. Lots more to explore there. Do have a look. Join us on Facebook and Twitter. If you'd like to support the podcast, patreon.com/PaulCorenza is where you can do that. £5 a month gets you videos and writings and extra bits and pieces on our broadcasting history journey. Almost every couple of episodes now, we're finding new things, I think, about the old days. Just little minor things, but all things that hopefully help elevate and amplify those early pioneers. Thanks for being part of that journey. Do share this with anyone you think might enjoy this podcast. It's a solo run operation, not made by the BBC one jot. It's just us, happy few. Surely one of the most trimmed down, slim broadcasting operations there could be. Just me podcasting to you. Although, of course, nothing could be slimmer, trimmer, simpler, and more beautiful than just a cello and a nightingale.
The British Broadcasting Century is presented and produced by Paul Carenza. Original music is by Will Farmer. Archive clips are so old we believe they're all beyond copyright. If you disagree, do let us know. And we doff our caps to all who've produced, pioneered, and preserved any of these broadcasts and recordings over the years. This episode, we particularly doff our caps to Beatrice Harrison and to the Nameless Nightingales. Do review this podcast if you haven't already, wherever you found it, and do share it with others. It all helps inform, educate, and entertain on this wonderful broadcasting history story.
Next time, we go 1 year earlier, back to May 1923, to tell our moment-by-moment origin story of British broadcasting. Next time, the Grenadier Guards Band and early boycotts of the BBC. It's not going well in spring 1923 at the other end of this British broadcasting century.